Welcome to The Bookshelf. I'm Chris Massini. Tonight, a special conversation with Jess Walter. He's the author of 8 books, including the number one New York Times bestseller, Beautiful Ruins, The Zero, a finalist for the National Book Award, and Citizen Vince, winner of the Edgar Award. His work has been published in 32 languages, and his short fiction has appeared 3 times in Best American Short Stories. His new novel, The Cold Millions, which is due out October 25th, is set in Spokane during the labor disputes of the early 20th century. Hailed by the Philadelphia Inquirer as a Scorsese-esque period piece populated by cops, drunks, variety girls, temperance ladies, job sharks, Pinkertons, and Wobblies, the novel follows 2 adventure-seeking brothers, the wealthy enemies who threaten them, and the women who reveal to them an unjust world on the brink of upheaval. Jess lives here in his hometown, Spokane, and he joins me now to talk about the new novel. Jess, thanks for talking with me.
Thanks, Chris. Good to be here.
Well, I thought I'd start by talking about Spokane. So a lot of your fiction, readers of your work know, takes place in Spokane or somehow deals with characters or places around the Inland Northwest. But this novel is the first time that you really dove into a particular piece of Spokane history. So what piqued your interest in exploring the Wobblies and the free speech fights of the 1900s?
Boy, there were so many things that sort of came together to make me want to write about this period. I'd always wanted to write about the early 20th century in Spokane, in part because it exists so much in the world we see now. The architecture, every house I've lived in has been built between 1906 and 1909 for the last 30 years anyway. And so, it just feels ubiquitous to me. It's when Spokane was doubling in size every 6 or 7 years. And when I started doing the research, I just pictured this place that was becoming a modern city, really more respected than Seattle at the time, you know, other than San Francisco for theater, for wealth. Spokane was really one of the coming Western cities, but it also had the shades of this old Western town. And to read about the wild things that happened, that was sort of the first impulse. The second one was much more current, reading about the social unrest, the riots, the income inequality of the end of the Gilded Age. It felt like a way to write about the current moment while also writing about this period that had just always fascinated me.
Yeah, well, I definitely want to talk more about sort of the echoes of the current mm-hmm. moment, because they're really almost uncanny. But first, before we get there, I want to introduce a couple of the characters. So your main character is a 16-year-old boy named Rye Dolan. And when the book starts, he's sort of tramping around with his older brother, Gig, and they're looking for work, sort of picking up things where they can. And to me, it had a very sort of Steinbeckian feel about these characters. They're sort of drifters and tramps, but there's a sophistication about them. Can you tell us about the Dolan brothers and
yeah, it's one of those echoes. Their names are Gregory and Ryan, but when I gave them nicknames, I sort of loved the idea of hobos as the original gig economy. And so naming one of them Gig seemed sort of apt. But yeah, they are 2 brothers who adventure around the West, taking jobs where they can get them on log crews or as muckers for mining operations. And aside from the sort of economic desperation they live in, I did see them as a kind, you know, as the sort of adventuring brothers. It was very much the way Steinbeck would write about the characters in, say, Cannery Row or Sweet Thursday.
Yeah.
I liked that they had a sense of humor and a sense of aspiration. And for Gig and Rye, it's really, this is the only world they've known. And I've always, coming from a working class family myself, I've always loved those characters who aspire, and especially through books, which is kind of the vehicle that Gig and Rye arrive at, and specifically War and Peace, which Gig pronounces the greatest work of literature, even though he only owns 2/5 of it.
Yeah, well, he thinks he owns 2/3 of it for most
he
of
does.
The...
Yeah.
Turns out he didn't know the scope of it. But
right.
Yeah, that's a great sort of recurring motif of him reading War and Peace throughout the novel. Well, I wonder if you could read a section of the book to sort of get us into the world and the style of these characters for us.
Sure. I won't read the prologue, but I'll read just start from the first chapter with those two characters waking up. They woke on a ball field. Bums, tramps, hobos, stiffs, 2 dozen of them spread out on bedrolls and blankets in a narrow floodplain just below the skid, past taverns, tanners, and tents, shotgun shacks hung like hound's tongues over the Spokane River. Seasonal work over, they floated in from mines and farms and log camps, filled every flop and boarding house, slept in parks and alleys and pavilions of traveling preachers, and on the night just past, this abandoned ball field, its infield littered with itinerants, vagrants, floaters, Americans. The sun was just beginning to edge the mountains when Rye Dolan sat up, halfway down the first baseline. He looked across a field of sleeping humps, his older brother Gig beside him, curled a few feet from the pitcher's mound. Rye turned back to watch the sunrise over the Selkirks, a smoky red gash where someone had set a fire to get a job fighting it. Last year, Rye might have paid to get a shovel on that blaze, but Gig had gone and joined the IWW, the union fighting the corrupt employment agents who charged a buck for job leads. Left untended, that same dollar could bring his older brother plenty of trouble, like last night. Pay in pocket, Gig Dolan liked to bounce from Dutch Jakes to Jimmy Durkin's until the money ran out. And while caring for Rye the past year had half-tamed him, they were coming off 3 weeks apart, Rye picking up a late harvest near Rockford, Gig getting on a skid crew at a Springdale log camp. Fired for union agitating, Gig came back to booze it up with his East End labor pals and hawk day work at the city's vaudeville theaters. And it was there, among the freaks and jugglers, the variety houses and leg shows, that he happened to meet an actress named Ursula. Rye back in Spokane less than an hour before his brother was showing him a newspaper review of her show. And therein, Gig said.
That was my guest, Jess Walter, reading from his new novel, The Cold Millions, which is due out October 25th. So apart from those fictional characters, Rye and Gig and others, there's also several real historical people that we meet in this novel, notably Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, who was a real-life labor organizer. She plays a really central role in the novel, as well as a real-life police chief of Spokane. So what was the process like bringing those historical people to life as fictional characters?
Yeah, that's an interesting part for me to be doing this research and to find, you know, the real story of the labor riots of 1909, including Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, the pregnant 19-year-old who comes to Spokane and is, you know, and leads these riots in a way that I found remarkable. You know, I would find it remarkable now, but in 1909, 11 years before she had the right to vote, just the sort of audacity and courage of someone like that, that was a character that you just wanted to try to depict in fiction. And then just looking at the things that happened during those years, the book begins and ends with 2 police officers being shot, both of which really occurred. And just the violence of that time, it was such an unsettled time that I really wanted to set my characters almost in a parallel story and be able to write about those things that occurred in a way that, even though my fictional story bounces up against them, you could read the story of Elizabeth Gurley Flynn through here and get a pretty accurate version of what she would have gone through during that time. And the same, I think, with John Sullivan, the police captain, some of the other labor leaders, blending those historical figures, it's a thing that historical fiction writers do. And, you know, for me, it was kind of a great thrill because some of those characters are just as beguiling and fascinating as anyone I could have invented.
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe even more so. I mean, I think, yeah, especially Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, like you said, a 19-year-old pregnant labor organizer. If you'd made her up, she'd be almost too unbelievable for the time period.
Yeah, there were times I was working on the book, I was afraid that, you know, that she would almost take it over because her story is so rich. But I think they fit in. You know, I think fiction is a way to sort of, you know, bring you into scenes and into a place, and to also, you know, draw attention to certain aspects of what might have been going on during that time. So when I'm writing, I often will embed myself in research. And then there's a moment where the fiction department has to lay off everybody in the research department. And and we have to just get to the business of creating a story that hopefully works, you know, regardless of how my research came about.
Yeah. And, you know, I think all of your novels and stories seem really grounded and well-researched, but to my knowledge, this is your first really truly historical fiction novel. And so did you think about it in those terms? Like you said, you know, is this a different sort of beast than, say, Beautiful Ruins, which was had historical fiction elements of it, maybe being partially set in the 60s, but this you're really sort of going back to a particular time.
Yeah, I think it is more historical fiction. I probably, to my discredit, I never think of genre when I'm writing. Early on in my career, I think that was difficult for some bookstores and editors because I am notorious for not staying in my lane, I suppose. And I had one bookstore say, we have no idea where to shelve your books. Are they crime fiction? Are they literary fiction? Are they humorous? And I had never heard such a great compliment in my life. So I kind of like that. And this one, I think each book tells you what it wants to be. And I could not have, you know, I was so drawn to this era and to the parallels with the time we live in now, and so drawn to these characters, and so drawn to 1909 Spokane, blocks of brothels and boarding houses and vaudeville theaters next to these incredibly wealthy mining magnate homes. And again, it's you can walk through the city now and see the ghosts of this time. And so, you know, I think I really wanted to represent that period, not as it was, but as it might have been, as you know, and so the research really did become important. Once I'm in the story itself, I'm kind of just like any other reader. I want to know what happens to the characters. I want to, you know, find out where they go and what occurs to them. And so balancing that against the research. So, for instance, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn, you know, many of her lines in the novel are taken from her speeches. At the very end, the story of her trial comes directly out of the Spokesman Review and Spokane Chronicle papers and the Spokane Press, the populist paper at the time. So a lot of the research just was folded right in. In the end, I wrote the longest afterword I ever have written, just to sort of explain which parts of the novel were factual, because as a reader, that's what I would have wanted to know at the very end of the book. So rather than be coy and pretend as if I'd made all this up, I wanted to share with people a bit of my research process.
Yeah. Well, that afterward is helpful to sort of unpack, because that is, I think especially now, the first thing I would want to do is go to Wikipedia and sort of figure out which characters are real and which ones are not. So
I think that's triumph. Helpful. I think that's a triumph of historical fiction if it makes you want to go read more about it. And and so I hope people will. I hope they'll go read Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's autobiography or the stories of her life or read more about that early Spokane history.
Yeah. You're listening to The Bookshelf from Spokane Public Radio. I'm talking with best-selling author Jess Walter about his new novel, The Cold Millions, which is due out October 25th. So I want to get back to something we alluded to in the beginning, which is I read this book earlier this summer, and I had a really uncanny feeling reading the sections about labor protests and the brutality and violence of the police department in Spokane, during this summer when I couldn't help but conjure the images of Black Lives Matter protests, police in riot gear, clouds of tear gas literally filling the streets of Spokane. Do you find the themes of this book especially relevant, not just to the time when you were writing it, I presume, but now in the time when it's about to be read by the public?
I think more relevant and more resonant than when I was writing it. The main thing that I was looking at when I began was more the inequality between the wealthy and the poor, which has always struck me as one of the most overlooked qualities of the last 30 years. You know, we look at the stock market raging along, and we have pretty much decimated the middle class. And that's the class that as a kid I aspired to and that I mostly grew up in. And so to come from a working class family that had an avenue to financial security and to see that taken away has been heartbreaking for me as an American. And so that was the very first thing that I think pulled me in. Also just a sense that the world you want, the fairness that you desire is so far away. And that just felt the way it has felt for me since 2016, honestly. Mm-hmm. And so those were sort of the beginning things. I did not realize that the Black Lives Matter movement would erupt as it has, that police brutality would become such an issue again. I think I saw the vague echoes of that, but the summer we've just had, from the forest fires to a pandemic, it's very much early 20th century life that we're living through. You know, the period I'm writing about is sandwiched right between the Russian flu and the Spanish flu, right at the time of the Big Burn, the largest wildfire until this summer. Yeah. And then you've got social unrest, and at the very center of it, very center of the sorts of protests we're seeing now, Spokane, Washington. This was the first place that these labor riots really erupted, and the most successful use of nonviolent protest in America at the time was here, Elizabeth Gurley Flynn and the IWW.
Yeah. Well, I wonder if I could get you to read another short section of the book. I earmarked on page 50, there's a section there where that first riot is sort of erupting, and that moment felt really viscerally similar to this summer to me. So would you be willing to read part of that?
Yeah. So this section is in the midst of the first day of rioting, the first of almost 500 people to be arrested over the coming weeks. And the IWW has been banned from standing in the street. If more than three people gather, it's illegal. And so these first speeches have begun, and the police chief, John Sullivan, and his forces are rounding people up. "Disperse," the chief yelled to the crowd. "Next man steps on a box, gets it worse. Worse for each after." No one moved, neither Wobblies nor a crowd. And the chief turned and said something to Clegg. Then a voice in the crowd called out, "Hold the line." And that brought a cheer and more boos. A man calling, "Kill the bums." More cheers and chatter. The crowd speaking all at once, drowning out Sullivan. Then the people in front of Rye snapped their attention to the left as if a baseball had been lined up the middle. And Rye stood on tiptoes to see over the hats. Another box had appeared in the street, half a block north, and Frank Little was climbing on. This was the union's plan, after Walsh was arrested, to go up one after another in different spots, force the cops to scramble one end of downtown to the other, arrest dozens of them, and fill the jail with the only weapons they had, their bodies. "Brothers and sisters," Little began, but before he could say another word, a cop was on him and threw him to the street. He disappeared in the crowd like someone slipping beneath the waves. "Disperse," Sullivan yelled again, and the crowd took a few steps back but didn't leave. Wobblies pressing forward, onlookers straining to see, every window on Stephen Street now full of people sticking their heads out, and a man yelling from a second-story window of a lawyer's office, "This is freedom? You call this freedom?" A few minutes later, the same man appeared in the doorway of the building, face bloodied, pushed into the street by one of the security men, his glasses skittering onto the cobblestone as he cried, "What is my crime? What is my crime?" The crowd rumbled and muttered like it hadn't chosen which team to root for, heads swinging left and right at signs of action. To the south, a young woman in a plain gray smock yelled, "Wake up! Wake up!" And a cop pulled her down the street, and the crowd swung the other way to the north end of Stevens, where Frank Little had gone limp and was being dragged by the arms, his legs bumping on the streetcar tracks. His soapbox was still in the street, and a long bearded man climbed up and began singing with a heavy Slav accent the first lines of the Working Man's Star-Spangled Banner.
That was Jess Walter reading from his new novel, The Cold Millions. And yeah, reading that, I think I read that, you know, just a couple of weeks after the protests in Spokane that turned violent. And it was just so uncanny to read those descriptions of the mob moving back and forth and the police sort of meeting them at every turn.
It's interesting. Stevens Street at the time was filled with what were called job agencies. And to get any sort of work, you lined up there. And Spokane being the center of all of this agriculture and mining and logging, hobos and itinerants would come riding the rails or walking into town and would line up at these job agencies, and they were charged a dollar to get a job. And then those jobs often were pulled out from under them, and some of the job agencies were corrupt. And so that was sort of the center of these protests. And, you know, that first day was the biggest and erupted in a sort of riot. But those protests went on for more than a month, all the way through the spring, actually, from the fall through the spring, more than 500 people arrested. And the jail filled, the brig at Fort George Wright filled, and even the old Franklin, which was a high school, Franklin High School downtown, closed and converted into a jail and filled with protesters.
And, you know, there's another element of this book, or the world of this book, that I found really fascinating and weirdly relevant, and that's newspapers. So there's this ongoing struggle throughout the novel of the police and authorities shutting down these labor-backed newspapers, and then the unions trying to publish and get the word out about what's happening. And as a former newspaper reporter, are you nostalgic for that time when newspapers had this sort of life and death influence to them? Or how has that, I feel like now anyone with a cell phone camera can capture, you know, and publish the incidents of police brutality or other sorts of corruption or crime. But that volume has maybe diluted the power of the images.
Oh, undoubtedly. Yeah. And I think a distrust of what we're seeing, too. We don't tend to believe, you know, and maybe rightly so. It was so fascinating. And one of my biggest areas of research was just to pore over the microfilm and microfiche of newspapers from that time, the Spokesman Review and the Spokane Chronicle, both of which were establishment papers, but also the Industrial Worker, which was the newspaper of that nascent labor union, the Industrial Workers of the World, and the Spokane Press, which was a Hearst newspaper, a populist newspaper, and so which covered things from more of the working man's aspect. And I would read the same event covered by these four different newspapers, and you end up with a sort of almost a cubist version of things. You're seeing, you know, sharp angles, the establishment, you know, pushing for these protesters to be treated in a way that, you know, kept business flowing, while, you know, the more populist and labor newspapers would really show the plight of these people. And so triangulating those events that way was so fascinating. And it seems like a recent development that you choose your news channel to choose your reality, that you choose Fox or MSNBC. But in the same way you read a newspaper, you chose to, you know, read the Press or the Industrial Worker or the Chronicle or the Review to see what, you know, to see what you believed and to kind of reconfirm those things. So it was, and I have, I can make myself romantic about many parts of this story. Both of my grandfathers were itinerant workers, and my grandpa Jess, who I'm named after, would tell me stories of riding the rails. And he first arrived in Spokane as a itinerant worker, as a hobo riding the rails looking for agriculture work. Wow. That was the first time he came here, a generation later in the 1930s. But he always made it sound so adventurous. And in the same way, I felt great romance for the newspapers of the time, reading those stories. And in a time when, you know, every day the newspaper was out being hawked on the street. The immediacy of news is the other thing.
Yeah.
Elizabeth Gurley Flynn's verdict wasn't an hour in before the first special newspapers were on the street being sold.
Wow.
Everything we think is so new now, that immediacy of news, you know, they were out printing Bulldog special editions and having newsboys hawk them on the street, you know, not long after events happened. And so you really do feel like this recurrent, you know, sense of history when you're researching something like this.
Yeah. And I think that's just one of the pleasures of this book is seeing those themes that, as you said, you're writing about the present moment by reflecting what happened in the past, you know, more than 100 years ago.
It almost seemed as if I could avoid being didactic that way, too.
You know,
I could avoid stepping in politics or, you know, and just writing more about how these systems and these human truths keep coming back up, how, you know, this fight for economic justice and racial justice, which now is being led by young people who walk out of their schools for climate change or who walk out of their schools for sensible gun safety, or who lead Black Lives Matter. And 110 years ago, it was young workers like Elizabeth, like Gagan Rai, or organizers like Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. You know, it was still young people whose idealism and energy caused change in the world. And I find great inspiration in that.
Yeah. Well, you're embarking shortly on a series of virtual events to promote this book, including one with the Spokesman Review's Northwest Passages Book Club on October 26th. What's it been like trying to get ready to release a book during a global pandemic?
Well, I mean, I think all of us are going through so much that I don't have, you know, young children at home to try to teach while I'm working. So whatever changes it'll be for me won't actually be that significant, I think. But this will be the first book tour I've done from my office. You know, usually I get to hop on a plane and go to New York and, San Francisco and Chicago. And, you know, my 16-city book tour is pretty much going to be done from my favorite city, Spokane.
Yeah. Well, my guest has been Jess Walter. His new novel is The Cold Millions, due out October 25th, and available to pre-order now from your local independent bookstore or HarperCollins publishers. As I said, he'll be hosting a virtual event with the Spokesman Review's Northwest Passages Book Club on Monday, October 26th. Jess, thanks so much for taking the time to talk with me.
Thank you, Chris.
You've been listening to The Bookshelf, a production of Spokane Public Radio. If you want to listen back to our conversation with Jess Walter or many other episodes of The Bookshelf, you can find those at spokanepublicradio.org. I'm Chris Messini. Thanks for listening.